From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. On this week's podcast, climate change has some scientists turning to radical solutions.
If you try to manage global climate change by sucking carbon back out of the atmosphere, you're trying to empty a swimming pool by sucking through a straw.
Scientists are hacking the climate and insect brains. But don't be afraid of cyborg cockroaches. They're here to help.
We can use this collection of agents to do an exploration of the entire space to be able to localize potential people that may be trapped in the ruins after these disasters.
Then we hear from a man who's an expert in his field.
It's probably safe to say that I'm one of the top 4 in the morning experts in the world.
And Anushka Shankar's tribute to her dad.
Wasn't left unsaid. Thank you. That was left unsaid.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West.
I don't know what was said.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. In the summer of 2012, a small group, a part of the Haida people, a native community in Canada, had a problem. The salmon they rely on were disappearing. So the Haida took matters into their own hands. They partnered with an American businessman, drew up plans, and then took a boat full of iron dust into the waters off their home island. They spread the iron dust across the water, creating a giant algae bloom. They hoped the algae would soak up carbon dioxide and bring back the fish. The reaction to the experiment was immediate and negative.
It is being called the world's biggest geoengineering experiment.
A geoengineer goes rogue. This week, news broke of a massive project to try to absorb carbon in the atmosphere.
Into the Pacific Ocean off the Canadian coast. It was described as the world's first rogue geoengineering project, an example of how the Earth's fragile systems could be tampered with.
While it scared a lot of people and angered a lot of scientists, this event could be a sign of what's to come, because some very mainstream scientists are saying that the climate change situation is so bad that saving life as we know it might require something radical, like shooting chemicals into the stratosphere to reflect sunlight, in essence, hacking the climate. And that's our cover story today. So it's come to this. In scientific circles, what the Haida did is called ocean fertilization. Jason McNamee is a spokesman for the group that carried out the experiment. He says the goal for the Haida people was simply to protect their livelihood.
They get most of their protein straight out of the ocean. What they have noticed over the last 100 or so years is that the fisheries have become less predictable and less abundant.
And while it's still unclear how successful the operation was, scientifically speaking, the legal and social backlash was immediately apparent. The Canadian government condemned the dump and has launched an investigation, seizing documents and data from the headquarters of the native company. Matthew Watson is a climate scientist at the University of Bristol and the author of the blog, The Reluctant Geoengineer.
So this is the really knotty problem, right? So if that project had been solely about salmon, nobody would have batted an eyelid. But because it was really about geoengineering, people got very, very worried.
People get scared because a lot of these plans sound like mad scientist schemes. Ocean fertilization is just one of a wide array of climate engineering techniques that are out there. Technique number one, suck the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put it somewhere else. Again, Matthew Watson.
One might do that by planting lots of trees, or setting up machines that draw down CO2 and store it somewhere, or generating ocean fertilization, where you add iron to the ocean and that generates phytoplankton, which locks up carbon dioxide. The whole point is that you're trying to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put it somewhere else.
Technique number two, try to reflect sunlight away from the Earth to keep the Earth cooler.
And you can do that by painting roofs white or through making natural clouds, meteorological clouds, a little brighter, or through volcanic aerosols.
In fact, there is evidence of volcanic eruptions that have dramatically lowered the temperature on Earth. Scientists want to replicate that. The catch is that scientists haven't really tested either technique. Matt Watson.
For the most part, we've got more questions than answers. It's a very, very emotive subject and a divisive subject. So I can think of academics that would agree on almost everything else in terms of science that are diametrically opposed on geoengineering. Some people see it as a necessary evil to protect the environment, and some people see it as a retention of the status quo, just trying to techno-fix our way out of what is already a technological problem.
If the schism in the science community weren't enough, Watson points out that there are serious questions about the basic feasibility of actually using any of these techniques. And what's already a divisive problem in the sciences is quickly becoming a governance nightmare.
So the open question would be, if you fertilize the oceans really aggressively and you did something appalling to somebody's fish stocks, I don't know, off the coast of a developing world island, who would pay for the damage according to that? The way I described the techniques the first time round was by technologies. A better way to categorize the technologies might be whether or not they have a local or a global scale. Things like painting roofs white or planting trees, they might be seen to be done on a local scale, whereas actually things like volcanic aerosols and ocean fertilization is they act on your atmosphere, my atmosphere, people in Bangladesh's atmosphere, and they're much less controllable because they have a global effect.
Matthew Watson is a climate scientist at the University of Bristol. Considering the potential global effects of climate engineering, most governments have been slow to take on the issue. Ted Parson is an environmental law professor at UCLA. He works on the tough question of how international bodies should regulate climate engineering.
There's a fairly active debate on whether international law exists or covers this right now. So I'm of the view that, in fact, there really isn't any binding or constraining international law right now that limits nations' ability to do this. There are a number of environmental treaties that are relevant to doing this, but they're all rather narrow in the constraints and obligations they impose. So none of them would have the effect of prohibiting the United States or China or any other country from doing this. The Convention on Biological Diversity has adopted a couple of decisions that express disapproval of geoengineering technologies, but they are very vague, flabby, non-binding decisions. They really don't have much more than an expressive value of saying, whoa, we don't like this.
And domestically, how has the United States dealt with the issue of climate engineering?
The United States has not dealt with the issue of climate engineering at all yet. And the United States is in a situation similar to many other countries right now, where I think people are so afraid of these technologies and of the potential for intense political controversy they hold, that nobody's even talking about them. And one unfortunate consequence of that is that early small-scale research that could help us understand more about whether these things would work, what risks they would pose, and how you would do them most effectively and in the lowest risk way, isn't really getting done. And that's really quite a risky situation, because if we find ourselves in a situation where climate change gets really bad and we're kind of desperately looking around for something to do to make it less bad, if we haven't done the research at that point, all we'll have is a set of kind of untested, unrisk-assessed, undeveloped options that are kind of crude to throw up in a hurry.
By now, you're probably wondering, what about the potential for harm? If scientists get the calculations wrong, it could be catastrophic for life on Earth. Or what if the technology got into the wrong hands? Couldn't someone shoot poison into the atmosphere? Or fry their enemies with space mirrors?
Well, it's very challenging. There's a few ideas out there that I think of as the Dr. Evil idea, which is that some evil scientist on his tropical island lair with a great big antenna pointing to the sky can go, nya-ha-ha, you know, those fools, now they'll have to pay attention to me, and pull a big lever and, like, mess up the climate for the world. It can't work like that, because even when you put stuff in the stratosphere, it falls down over 6 months to a year or two. That means that Dr. Evil can't make his once-and-for-all intervention. Dr. Evil would have to have a great big airport and a supply chain and a bunch of airplanes that are going up all the time. There's probably only, like, maybe 10 or 12 nation-states that could actually sustain a program of changing the global climate in a way that wouldn't be trivial. Now, 10 or 12 is still a big enough number that you worry about, my goodness, how will we coordinate and prevent rogue action and get them to agree? But it's a lot less scary than 200 states and 2,000 non-state actors.
Ted Parson of UCLA. One of the wild things about geoengineering is that no one really wants to do it or thinks it's a great idea, even the scientists who are proposing it. It's just a sign of how bad things are. Again, Matthew Watson.
I guess that's why I push the research agenda so hard. I'm pretty appalled by the idea of full-scale deployment, but I'm also pretty worried about burying our heads in the sand and not thinking about what that would mean.
But where does this leave the Haida people of Canada and other communities already feeling the negative effects of climate change? The actual results of the Canadian experiment are unclear. What we do know is that it created an algae bloom visible from space. But what did the bloom do for the fish the Haida rely on? Well, the answer to that question is also complicated and controversial. Jason McNamee can't say for sure what the result was.
We don't know yet. We haven't got through all of our data. But I can tell you, this year, Alaska, particularly Southeast Alaska, had their best salmon fishing year ever.
But Ted Parsons doesn't buy it.
Fish stocks fluctuate a great deal from year to year. There is no basis for claiming that this intervention made any difference. The claims of the proponents that it usefully demonstrated how to do this and that they could have generated carbon credits or brought back depleted salmon stocks have no basis. And indeed, the intervention wasn't even controlled well enough for it to be a defensible scientific experiment of any kind.
I asked Jason McNamee about what the Haida feel they can do in the wake of the uproar about their ocean fertilization experiment. So would you do it again?
Well, we certainly would like to, but there have been an awful lot of concerns that have been raised by various stakeholders. So would we like to do it again as another research project? Absolutely.
In the coming years, the Haida may not be so alone in their willingness to try new ways to engineer a cooler climate. A new website popped up recently that caught our eye. It's called The Museum of Four in the Morning.
Well, you should have come to the feist party. We didn't get home till around 4 a.m.
The site gathers clips of the seemingly endless pop culture references to 4 a.m., from movies to TV.
I woke up at 4 a.m. by accident.
To music.
Four in the morning.
It's all been collected by this guy.
It's probably safe to say that I'm one of the top 4 in the morning experts in the world.
That's John Reeves. Everyone just calls him Reeves.
One, my collection must be among the top. And two, there's no second place, dude. You know what I mean? Like, it's me. I'm the guy.
Reeves is a poet and performer. And the story starts in 2007 when he was invited to give a TED Talk.
And I thought, wow, what if I did a talk that was cockamamie? What if I was an expert on something that was inconsequential?
This is a recent comic strip from the Los Angeles Times. The punchline? On the other hand, I don't have to get up at 4 every single morning to milk my Labrador.
Reeves presented himself as an expert on 4 in the morning. He pulled together examples from The Simpsons and Bill Clinton's autobiography, evidence of a 4 a.m. conspiracy.
I know a coded message when I see one.
It was a joke. That's it. But when the TED Talk went online, people started sending him more and more examples. Some obvious ones, like the Farron Young song.
It's 4 in the morning and once more.
Some esoteric.
There's a book called Grilled Cheese at 4 in the Morning for people with juvenile diabetes.
And then stuff Reeves had never, ever heard of.
Crochet Today magazine from the fall issue of a couple years ago with an adorable crocheted alarm clock, which is clearly set at 4 o'clock.
But it's 4 in the morning and what's more, the dawn and just woke up.
At first, it caught him off guard.
This is crazy. What am I going to do with all this stuff? But then, I honestly started to get a major, major curatorial mojo.
Now he says there is something special about that hour, or at least the idea of it.
Pretty clearly, it's the one time where you are either up too late or you've gotten up too early.
It's a popular shorthand, across genres and even centuries.
Girl with the Dragon Tattoo has 3 Four in the Morning references, but Shakespeare's got 4 different plays with them. Cymbeline, Henry IV, Richard III, Measure for Measure.
We did a little digging of our own, and it wasn't hard to find references in the NPR archives.
She actually rolled out of bed at 4 in the morning.
At 4 in the morning.
Yeah, it was at 4 in the morning.
Bowling at 4 in the morning. You're pointing to the clock. It's 4 in the morning.
Reeves says that now you've heard about the 4 a.m. phenomenon, you'll start to see it everywhere. And he says, keep the submissions coming. Have you ever wanted to control your own cyborg cockroach? Soon you'll be able to direct the path of a cockroach with a smartphone and the swipe of your finger. Dr. Greg Gage is the co-founder of Backyard Brains. He and his colleagues have developed a device they call RoboRoach. It might make you squirm, but Gage says the device could inspire a new generation of neuroscientists.
The sharpest kids amongst us are probably going into other fields right now, and so we're kind of in the dark ages when it comes to neuroscience. So getting kids interested in neuroscience early enough when they can still make their decisions on what they want to do in their careers is kind of important.
And a cyborg cockroach might be the inspiration.
The neurons in the insect are very, very similar to the neurons inside the human brain. It's a beautiful way to really understand what's happening inside your brain by looking at these little insects.
The idea was spawned by a device they developed called the Spiker Box, capable of amplifying real living neurons. Insert a small wire into a cockroach's antennae, and this is what you hear. It's the sound of actual neurons.
Lining the inside of the cockroach are these neurons that are picking up touch or vibration sensing, chemical sensing around there, so they use it like a nose or like a large tongue, their antennas. And they use it to sort of navigate the world. And so when you put a small wire inside of there, you can actually pick up the information as it's being encoded and being sent to the brain.
With the RoboRoach device and smartphone app, you interact with the antennae to influence the insect's behavior.
It's a small backpack, which we can then communicate through a mobile phone. And so we use Bluetooth. When you swipe your finger across the screen of your mobile phone, it sends a message to the backpack, which then sends a small pulse of electricity into the left or right antenna.
The result? A cockroach that follows your directions. Since Gage introduced the RoboRoach at a TEDx conference earlier this month, it has stirred up some ethical concerns. But Gage says his roaches are no different from working farm animals.
Like the bridle of a horse, and you can have these reins, you can kind of pull the horse left or right. You can do the same thing with the cockroach because it thinks it's being touched on the left and right side and it will sort of turn in the contralateral direction.
And like an ornery horse, a RoboRoach can decide to stop listening.
It only works for about 5 or 10 minutes and the cockroach tends to ignore it. The brain adapts, is what it does, and so we actually can see that in real time with these cockroaches.
With the RoboRoach, you can wield influence over a single insect. But what about swarms of these cyborg cockroaches? Dr. Edgar Lobaton is an assistant professor at North Carolina State University. He's in the simulation phase of his latest project, utilizing swarms of up to 1,000 cockroaches to assist in search and rescue operations.
We can use this collection of agents to do an exploration of the entire space to be able to localize potential people that may be trapped.
Wearing backpacks similar to the RoboRoach, their movements can composite a map of structures like a collapsed building. Lobaton says cockroaches are perfect for the job. They're natural explorers.
For this particular kind of insects, actually, they have gone through a lot of evolution. There's a lot of development in there to make them very flexible and to be able to accomplish things related to exploration and the search of food. So what we're trying to do is exploit basically this design from nature to be able to use it in our advantage.
So maybe you should think twice before stomping or spraying the next cockroach you encounter. Swarms of cockroaches could be deployed to save your life one day, or at least teach you or your kids a little bit about neuroscience. We still don't have a clear picture of what America's involvement in Afghanistan will look like after next year. Even if some troops remain beyond 2014, it'll be the tiniest fraction of the approximately 60,000 troops now present, and a dramatic change in a relationship defined by 12 years of war. Kevin Seitz has been reporting on Afghanistan since the U.S. invasion in 2001. In June, he made his fifth trip to the country in an attempt to understand what has happened there since he first went. He told me about a local warlord he spent time with, named Nabi Gichi.
There hadn't been any real police or security presence in the region that he was from Khalizal. And so the village elders stepped in and asked him if he would provide security. And he did a very good job. He was an incredible Taliban killer and so effective that the U.S. actually put him in a program where they kind of badge these warlords. They give them a badge and they train them a little bit. But there was some controversy with the program. President Karzai didn't know it existed, and so it was disbanded. But he continued providing security for the region, but also taxing the people for that security.
One of the things that's amazing about Nabi, as you describe him, is that he has skills beyond being a great fighter. He's very resourceful.
I spent a night at Nabi Gichi's compound. And the next day, you know, I'd heard this kind of mechanical sound coming from underneath his house. So that morning, Nabi Gichi takes me underneath his house, and Nabi Gichi had built a hydroelectric power plant underneath his house. He had diverted part of the Kunduz River, and he was generating so much electricity that there were no blackouts in his village area. He was supplying electricity not only to himself, but to the businesses and to residences around there. And he was, of course, charging them as well. And I think in some ways it was a metaphor for some of the things that we've overlooked, that Afghans can solve their own problems, but we need to help them in a more effective way.
So there are the unofficial forces like Nabi and his people that you've talked about, but also there are the official security forces like the Afghan army and the Afghan national police. Now, we've heard a lot about the army, but I had no idea before I read your piece how many Afghan national police, they're just dying in droves.
In the last few months, there have been thousands of Afghan local police and Afghan national police that have died. And there's a couple of reasons for that. You know, often they're posted in these remote areas where roadside bombs are used, or even donkey bombs. They'll attach a bomb onto a donkey and send it, you know, into a police checkpoint, and they'll detonate it. But they're very poorly trained. They get about 6 months of training. They're given a gun, and a lot of these guys had been farmers before, taxi drivers, but they're out on the front lines, and in a lot of cases, they end up being the first target. The other problem with this is the fact that, you know, these Afghan national police are kind of the face of the national government. And in some ways, unfortunately, they don't look very effective. There's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of bribe taking. The critics of the Afghan national police said, you know, all you've done is made these guys more effective at stealing. You've given them a gun to do it now. Although, you know, many of them are fighting and feel like they do have something worth fighting for, and they certainly are dying in droves.
So talking about, you know, when you were first there in 2001, I'm wondering what sort of sense you have looking at it 12 years later, your perspective on the war in the last 12 years.
There are improvements, and I think for many Afghans, they feel that there are things worth fighting for, but it's, you know, it's a paradox in some ways. They appreciate some of the investment that has been made, the huge investment, although it hasn't been done very effectively. In some ways, it's kind of been sprayed into Afghanistan like a fire hose. But people tell me, they said, you know, our lives have changed. Even the Taliban's lives have changed because of this investment. One of the things that I saw that I'm most concerned about, though, is that with this aid, there was an unintended consequence. Many of the educated Afghans, especially my friends, have gotten jobs with USAID, the United States Aid in International Development. And they've done good work, but the problem is they've been given this job that has an ending point. And so they work and they're able to support their families and they build infrastructure, they build roads, but those jobs end and they're still not within the government. The people that run the government are still the warlords. And so we haven't created a civil service, a bureaucracy that's effective. And unfortunately, I think that is going to be probably the weak link in the whole process.
That's reporter Kevin Seitz. You can find his story in Vice magazine. It's called Swimming with the Warlords. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
From NPR West, it's All Things Considered. I'm Arun Roth. The movie Captain Phillips spent a second weekend at number 2 in the box office. It's based on the true story of the hijacking of the Maersk, Alabama. 4 years ago, pirates attacked the freighter ship off the coast of Somalia. The film stars Tom Hanks as the title character, Captain Richard Phillips, and Barkhad Abdi as the man who leads the charge to capture the ship and crew.
Look at me. Sure. Look at me. Sure. I'm the captain now.
Abdi was born in Somalia, moved to Yemen when he was 7, and then to Minneapolis, Minnesota at 14. He learned about this role from a TV ad.
It came on the local TV channel, casting call, Tom Hanks film, Somali actress. And I went there to give it a chance.
So just a wide open casting call, and had to have been a lot of people showed up for that, right?
Yeah, it was about close to 800 people was there auditioning. You have to wait in line, and after a long day of waiting, I was given a script. I was assigned to a character, Musi.
Captain,
the ship's broken.
Captain, no one get hurt if you don't play no game.
The ship's broken. We had to go.
Nobody gets hurt.
Have you done any acting before?
You know, I have not done any acting before. I shot some music videos, but I was never in front of camera. Then this was my first time acting or even thinking about acting.
You knew the story that the film was portraying. Did you have any concerns about auditioning for a role like this, worried about maybe the way that Somalis were going to be portrayed?
Well, people around me did, you know, but to me, it was just an opportunity. I knew it was a true story, so it was just a chance that I can take.
Stop the ship!
I'm thinking about some of the scenes in the film where this tiny little skiff is attacking this giant shipping vessel.
Right.
What was it like, you know, learning how to go through that and doing the staging of it?
You know, I went through about a month and a half of training on the basics of the film. You know, my character, you know, he's a pirate. He is someone that's used to the waters, someone that's used to weapons, fighting, skiffs. So I had to learn all that. Most importantly, I had to learn how to swim.
You didn't know how to swim?
No.
Obviously, you're not a pirate, so how was it, you know, not being an actor, to relate to this character? I mean, what did you find in him to relate with?
It was difficult at first, but, you know, when I really thought of the actual character, he's a very desperate guy that have this only chance to be something. I relate to him simply because I was born in Somalia. I lived there till I was 7 years old, and I witnessed a whole year of the war. Killings, rape, you name it. I was really blessed to have parents that got me out. Certainly he did not have that. I look at him as someone that have nothing to lose. Man that have nothing to lose is very dangerous. So that's how I became his character.
Can I ask you, what was it like working with Tom Hanks?
It was an honor, you know, it was an honor. I did not expect him to be that nice, honestly. He's a very humble guy, and he's a hardworking man.
You came to America when you were 14. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you when you first came to America?
You know, it was exciting, but at the same time, it was life-changing. I had to start high school at a country that I don't speak the language, and it was hard. At the same time, it was easy because of the large Somali community in Minneapolis. I fit right in, honestly. It was just a whole new life for me.
You're off to a pretty amazing start as an actor. Your performance has been praised by a lot of critics. I'm wondering, are you going to keep on with this now as a career?
You know, that's what I want to do. I want to give it a chance, and I want to see if this was the only character I can act or I can act.
Are there other sorts of roles you'd like to play? Would you like to play a hero?
I don't think of myself as a hero, honestly, but I'm an open person, you know, I don't know. That'd be a better look for my family, I guess.
Right. With this incident that's dramatized in the film Captain Phillips, a lot of Americans, you know, all they know about it was what they heard in the news. And there's, I think it's safe to say in the film, there's a lot more context to the experience of the Somalis. What are you hoping that people will take away from the film in America?
I hope people will understand the culture clash between this very, very different characters, Captain Phillips and Musi. You know, one had just the normal life. You know, he went to school, college, graduated, family, and now he have a job. And the other one is just someone that grew up in a war-torn country that have, you know, no hope, no school, no job, no government, nothing. And they meet in something that's on forces outside of their control. And, you know, that shows a lot about life. You live life and, you know, you have to survive somehow, some way, and, you know, you just live it, you know, and you never give up and you just keep going.
Barkha Dabdi stars in the film Captain Phillips. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Since moving to NPR West in Culver City, we've started a new segment called The New and the Next. Every week, Carlos Watson, founder of the online magazine Ozzy, joins me to talk about, well, what's new and what's next. And starting this week, we're bringing The New and the Next to our podcast listeners as well. Let us know what you think at npr.org or on Twitter at NPRWATC. Carlos, welcome back.
Arun, I had to come down to LA, see you in person. Good to be here.
It's good to have you here in person. So, Carlos, even though we're a couple weeks away, Halloween is in the air. We're always getting to holidays early, which is kind of weird here because there aren't really fall colors in Los Angeles. But you guys have an unusual horror movie trailer that you're featuring this week.
We do. So, and this thing is going viral. It's been a very cool director named Joe Nicolosi. Basically spoofs all the horror films we're used to seeing and says, what if people actually acted reasonably in these things? What if there was logic?
Me and the girls were wanting to sneak into an abandoned mental asylum this weekend with our Ouija board. Do you want to come?
No, I don't.
Very, very funny. You absolutely have to watch. Only 3 minutes long.
I mean, we've seen those movies so many times that when we hear a cop saying, you know what, I'm going to call for backup. it's just hilarious.
Kind of anticlimactic.
Even funnier, I think my favorite thing you guys have this week, you have a feature about a comic featuring two characters from the world of hard rock, punk rock even. That's Henry Rollins, formerly of Black Flag, and Glenn Danzig. And these are kind of sort of buff guys. They sort of corner the market on black T-shirts, kind of serious, very metalish. But this comic has them cast in a different light.
So Tom Neely, an artist, a couple years ago said, what if you took these two hardcore rockers, Henry Rollins, Glenn Danzig, they're known as tough guys, and instead of making them friends and buddies and sometimes competitors, what if you made them lovers? What if you made a cartoon out of it and called it Henry and Glenn Forever?
Here's a snippet of some typical dialogue between the two, read by a couple of our staffers.
Glenn, do you ever look out at the city and think, about what? How black it would be if the lights went out? No, how there is someone for everyone.
And while Henry Rollins laughed at it and kind of enjoyed it, Glenn Danzig didn't find it quite so funny.
No.
Yeah, so
not really a sense of humor.
You know, it's funny. Those guys have been good buddies. They've spent a lot of time together on and off the road. But I guess for him, it wasn't what he was expecting. But so many people have enjoyed it. And one of the interesting things that Tom Neely said is that there were talks for a TV show. But
I want to see it.
Well, you know, so do I. But I think Glenn's unhappiness with the story has put it on pause for the moment.
Another piece you have this week, it's a DC character. She's a humanitarian with a unique philosophy.
Yeah, Sarah Holwinski, a 36-year-old woman, formerly was working on a lot of health policy. And she's taken over the Center for Civilian Conflict and has been an interesting and sometimes controversial figure. She said that we should count how many civilians are actually killed, hurt, or injured. And you remember originally when we were in Iraq, General Tommy Franks famously said, we're not going to count civilian casualties.
You know, it's interesting. Actually, I know Sarah from interviewing her a couple of times for work that I'd done looking into this. And she was – what's wild is that she did this work counting civilian casualties and then ended up working with the Army.
So Petraeus, General David Petraeus, when he was running the conflict over there in Iraq and Afghanistan, called her over to consult with her and ask whether or not there was a way that the American military and others can go about war that would have fewer civilian casualties. Now, supporters say it's good that someone's thinking about this. On the other hand, there are critics who say that anyone who talks like this is enabling, and that the reality is that there's not a cleaner way to do war.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Aussie. Carlos, great to see you again.
Always good to see you.
Once again, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. When master sitar player Ravi Shankar died last December, he left behind a couple of daughters who followed in his footsteps, though along very different paths and on different continents. Nora Jones was born in Brooklyn. I'm sure you've heard her sing.
I waited till I saw the sun. I don't know why I didn't come.
Half a world away, her half-sister, Anushka Shankar, studied sitar at their father's side. For Anushka Shankar's new album, Traces of You, she and Nora decided to record together, and it was during those sessions that their father died. They'd only worked together once before, so this was a new way to bond.
Yeah, it was a really amazing experience to get to work with her, actually. You know, whenever I get to work with someone I actually love and I'm close to, it adds another special dimension to the musical collaboration.
The first song featuring your sister, it's called The Sun Won't Set, and you have a lovely explanation for the title of that song. Could you talk about it?
Yeah, well, when I wrote the song, I was with Nathan Soni, my producer, on the record, and I was sort of explaining to him how I wanted to get some emotions out around the fact that my father wasn't well at the time. It was still a few months before he passed away, but I didn't want to be really direct about it.
The sun won't set. Not now, not yet.
I know that my dad's name Ravi means sun in Sanskrit, and so I was toying with the idea of the sun won't set, not now, not yet, as a refrain to play around. And the whole song is kind of using the idea of sun as a poetic placekeeper for his name, really.
Golden ember spinning round. The day is almost done. I wonder how it felt beneath the early sun. Each sunset keeps me still. The tree has shed its leaves. The wind, the evening chill is hardest to see.
You mentioned your producer, Nitin, and remarkably, he also lost his father while you were recording this album. And I'm wondering about how, you know, that worked in with all of this. How did that work for the sessions you were doing?
Well, it was something really huge that hung over the entire process, as you can imagine. And you know, obviously neither of us could have imagined we'd both simultaneously be going through that while working together, and so it influenced all of the music. And perhaps, you know, I can't obviously speak for him, but I hasten to guess it was a place that both of us could kind of put some of our emotions around that stuff, and there was a way in which we could quite uniquely write together about emotions that are actually quite personal because we were going through them at the same time.
And he's a pianist, a really remarkable pianist, in addition to producing and doing other things that we hear on the album. I'm kind of amazed by how well you can blend the sitar with a piano, because I think, you know, the tunings are so different and the scales are so different. But how do you work that out with him?
Well, Nitin is known for his ability to blend styles and work within an array of different cultures of music. And he's an amazing guitar player, pianist. And the piano can often cover the sitar with its resonance. And he was very sensitive about the way he approached the piano when we would work on sitar and piano together. As far as the tuning goes, I'm quite used to that because I work with Western music a lot, and when I do that, I do have to slightly alter the micro-tuning of the sitar to kind of fit Western scales a bit better.
One of my favorite tracks on the album, and I have a lot of favorites on the album, there's some really beautiful stuff. But in particular, Metamorphosis is a beautiful piece, and it incorporates Sanskrit chanting that ordinarily you'd hear just a single priest doing that in a temple, but you have it as kind of like a harmonized chorus almost.
I did that with two lovely singers who are based in San Diego, actually, and we recorded it and doubled it up to make it sound quite symphonic and full. And if one's ever heard, you know, a room full of priests reciting chants together, it's incredibly powerful. I always get goosebumps when I hear that, and I wanted to try and emulate that, but of course kind of set it to a particular tempo within the song and stuff, but it's recited very much within the traditional style.
Well, it's interesting being able to blend those things because, you know, to speak in sort of rough terms, Indian classical music tends to be so melodically oriented, and there's not the harmonies the way that there are in Western composed music. And to sort of hear them together, it's an interesting feeling.
It's a tough one, that. It's got a really fine line where you tip in one direction or the other, because sometimes I work in a way that harmony can only be used in ways that employ notes that are in a raga, and that can sound very pleasing to an Indian ear and sound somewhat simplistic or strange to someone who's more used to harmony. Similarly, you can go in the other direction and do more sophisticated harmonies underneath an Indian melody, and that might sound downright outrageous to an Indian ear because it's employing notes that aren't in the raga. So it's a really tough one to make a choice on. And I tend to choose differently song to song, I find.
I love the story. It's kind of amazing about how Nora came up with the melody for the song Unsaid. Could you tell the story?
Unsaid was, of the three songs we did together, this was the one we really wrote together from the ground up. And I knew I wanted there to be a third song when I was traveling to New York and didn't have it yet, and started writing the lyrics on the plane. And I ended up with all the lyrics ready, but the melody I was singing them in my head didn't really seem to fit once I was showing it to her. But as she was sort of sitting with the words and at the piano starting to try out different things, it was sounding weirdly familiar to me.
Wasn't left unsaid.
And I realized it was really close to the theme of Pather Panchali that our father had composed decades ago.
For people who aren't familiar, that's a classic Indian film.
And I've heard it said that it's like one of the best music and film marriages of all time as well. And so it's a very iconic melody. And when I said that to her, I was surprised to find out that she'd never actually seen that film and never heard that melody before. So it was a coincidence that she was singing in that melody. And it just kind of felt like a lovely kind of affirmation to me in a way that we were on the right track with that song, perhaps.
Love wasn't left unsaid. Thank you, that was left unsaid. I see you, maybe left unsaid. I don't know what was said.
Anushka, this was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anushka Shankar. Her new album is called Traces of You.
Love. Mm-hmm.
For the week ending October 20th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, and Jody Becker. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on Saturday and Sunday. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.